This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with attorney Flint Taylor about the sentencing on January 21st of this year of disgraced Chicago police commander John Burge, the Southside torturer. There are still many African-American men in prison, victimized by Burge and his subordinates. There's been no public apology to the African-American community for what's been done.
We'll talk with attorney Bill Goodman on the state of democratic rights in this country.
Bill Goodman, a remarkable civil rights attorney, gives us a seven-step program for determining whether we still have democracy left in America.
We speak with Sarah Hogarth, who just came back as part of a delegation that visited post an ongoing coup Honduras. Wait till you hear the stories of struggle by wide elements of the community, including community radio like WBAI, in resisting the American-backed coup.
Stay with us.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've reported for years on the ongoing developments in the Chicago torture case involving former Chicago police commander John Burge and others, including Mayor Richard Daley. Burge was sentenced on January 21st, 2011, to 4.5 years in prison by Judge Joan Lefkow. Instead of being sentenced for the repeated torture of people, which started in the early 80s, he was sentenced instead for obstruction of justice and perjury in making false claims on an interrogatory, inasmuch as the statute of limitations had run on the torture charges. Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office has been working on the torture cases in Chicago for some 25 years. Chicago has given $12 million in public money to the defense of John Burge and others. Burge is now 63 years old, retired on a taxpayer's pension, and living in South Florida. He had faced up to 45 years in prison. Attorney Flint Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be back.
Flint, you worked for over two decades on the torture scandal in Chicago, and you were there in Judge Joan Lefkow's courtroom on January 21st when she sentenced John Burge to 4.5 years of prison. Tell me what it was like to be in the courtroom that day.
Well, it was a culmination of a long struggle with regard to Burge and bringing some form of justice with regard to the heinous acts against humanity that he committed over a two-decade period here in Chicago. But, of course, it wasn't the end of the struggle that all of us have been involved in. Because there's so much left undone with regard to police torture and the scandal here in the city. Because Burge did not, of course, do this alone. He had many people working under him and with him. Those people are under investigation for the same kinds of charges, that being obstruction of justice and perjury, that Burge himself was prosecuted for. They need to be indicted and prosecuted as well. And there are over 20 men that are still behind bars based on tortured confessions that Burge and his men accomplished, and those men need to have new hearings and new trials. And there are civil suits and compensation for the victims of torture, the survivors, some of whom have lawsuits. The city to date has not settled all those cases and instead pours millions of dollars into the defense of Burge with private lawyers. That there needs to be compensation and treatment for all the men who were tortured, and that numbers are more than 100. And in fact, there needs to be an apology. There's a mayoral race out here, and since Danny Davis, the progressive congressman, withdrew from the race, there are three kind of Daley clones, one African-American, one Hispanic, and one white, who are running. Of course, the famous one is Ron Emanuel. None of them have seen fit to address what, in fact, the judge said and what, in fact, is a scandal of a mammoth proportions. And the judge cited the city and the police department as well as the state's attorney's office under Richard Daley as a dismal failure of leadership with regard to these cases. And so the new mayor needs to address all these issues with regard to the city. Particularly, we would like to see not only the compensation, the treatment, the stopping of defending Burge, but also an apology to the African-American community in general and to the victims and families of police torture. Those are some of the things that are still on the agenda. Being in the courtroom and hearing the judge, in fact, adopt our view that we fought so hard for all these years of the significance of the torture scandal and put the responsibility across the board on those whom it should have been put on, that was very rewarding. That's more rewarding than to see what turns out to be a broken down man with prostate cancer going to jail for 5 years. I think the significance of the judge's sentence has kind of been lost, particularly nationally, because people looked at the sentence and it's a little less than 5 years, and of course you should do much more than that for torture. But this really, unfortunately, thanks to Richard Daley and the prosecutors at the time back in the 80s who chose not to prosecute Burge. Even though it was a case about torture, the charges weren't torture. They were lying under oath about torture. So the judge had her hands tied to some degree, and she went as high as it, she felt she could in going double of the guidelines that were recommended. So on the one hand, we have a sentence that really doesn't add up to the underlying torture, but on the other hand, the judge certainly acknowledged and made findings commensurate with the seriousness of the scandal.
Yeah, she told Burge in her sentencing statement, and I'm quoting from the Chicago Sun-Times, "Unfortunately for you, the jury did not believe you, and I must agree, I did not either," the judge said. So it's been acknowledged that the guy's a liar, that he did what the community is saying he did, but nonetheless, she couldn't charge him what she could have or should have been able to do. And that brings me to the point of torture being a crime against humanity. Yet it wasn't prosecuted here in Chicago. It's not being prosecuted against Bush and Cheney and the lawyers that helped him. I wonder what your thoughts were on that aspect of this.
We've been actually raising for decades why there hasn't been prosecutions and why the prosecutor, Richard Daley, didn't prosecute for torture then when he was state's attorney, and why the U.S. attorney up until recently didn't prosecute, and at that point the statute had run on the underlying crimes. Obviously, it's a very troubling aspect of this scandal. On the other hand, in contrast to the Obama administration and its just failure or refusal to prosecute admitted torturers, and I'm talking about Bush, who admitted in his book that he authorized waterboarding. I'm talking about Cheney, who bragged about being involved in authorizing waterboarding. And I'm talking about those lawyers at the Justice Department who wrote long legal justifications for torture. No one's even investigating them. And so Chicago, in a way, is a beacon of light in the fight against torture. And people should look at it in that regard as well, that, you know, we fought for decades here to get the prosecutions, to get the convictions, to get the sentence, and to continue to get more prosecutions and hopefully convictions. And if it takes decades here, it may take decades with regard to Bush and Cheney and the like, but that doesn't mean that the people that are fighting for those prosecutions and trying to hold the Obama administration's feet to the fire on that issue, if that takes decades, well, it's worth the fight. If Burge and Cheney, that's a good Freudian slip, if Bush and Cheney and their boys get indicted 10, 15 years from now, well, you know, the Klansmen in the South who blew up the little girls in Birmingham and who killed the civil rights workers, some of them weren't indicted until they were 80 or 85 years old, but they were indicted and they were convicted. And those are the kinds of things, Burge, the Klan, Bush and Cheney, those are the fights worth fighting for, no matter how long it takes. And that's my thoughts on that.
Well, that's been your action, too. I mean, you talk about the definition of the word steadfast, Flint. You personify it. I wanted to ask you your evaluation of the role of the African-American community in Chicago and the role of the media, the aldermen. Why were you successful in Chicago? Of all places, when I came from Chicago, and I remember Lenny Bruce saying Chicago was so corrupt it was thrilling. Nonetheless, you were able to succeed at least partway now with getting Burge in prison and exposing a lot of this. And what was the role of the community in your efforts?
Obviously, the community's role was huge. The activist's role was huge. Not only the activists who were fighting against police brutality and police torture and for human rights, but there was also a very strong movement in the 90s that arose around the issue of the death penalty. And in some ways, the convergence of those movements, the movements against torture and for human rights and the movement against the death penalty, converged in the late 90s and in the early 2000s, when led to not only the clearing of death row by Governor Ryan and commuting all sentences of people on death row, but at the same time, he pardoned four of the men on death row on the basis of innocence and torture, because they had been tortured by Burge and his men. So you could see a very palpable coming together of that movement at that time. And it's really also very interesting that the same week that Burge was sentenced to the penitentiary and the judge cited the city and the county and the feds, all of them, in this dismal failure of leadership and implicated them in this scandal, that the legislature here in Illinois abolished the death penalty, and it's on the governor's desk. And so those two events are tied, really, in terms of the movements, and they're tied, of course, in terms of the human rights violations that they represent. So, yes, the African-American community was steadfast in this. The families, the men themselves who formed the Death Row 10, who were 10 men on death row who had been tortured, all of those aspects were extremely and continue to be extremely important in this struggle here in Chicago.
Yeah, I think it underlines what movement lawyers like you, Flint Taylor, have been saying all along. Yes, it takes difficult, strenuous legal action, but it takes the support of the community of people in the streets, and together you can bring about some justice. But without that support of the community, it's awfully hard to do it.
Definitely, and in fact, it's almost impossible if you're not working with and have behind you a movement. Then, in fact, you're kind of jousting at windmills.
Well, it struck me about the interaction between the police and the prosecutors and the judges and the politicians. They were all unified in perpetuating the torture and in covering it over for many, many years. And it was just a constant, several decade-long effort that finally brought Burge to the bar.
Well, it was kind of like a snowball in a way, and at some time the critical mass got too large, and it got going too fast downhill, so to speak. That was just like uncovering more and more evidence and exposing more and more evidence, and then you know getting the federal courts to recognize that there was a police torture scandal, and then getting the Illinois Supreme Court to recognize that there was a torture scandal and that it was torture and that men should have hearings based on the concept of torture. One of the biggest struggles that we fought for so long, and there was a conspiracy of silence around two aspects of this. One was that how racist it was. Of course, all the men were African-American, and all of the torturers, save one, were white. But that it was torture. It wasn't, quote, abuse. It wasn't, quote, brutality, which is the way the media wanted to play it. But it was torture.
It was utter torture. We should talk about that for our listeners. Yeah. Burge had been in Vietnam. Burge brought back with him the knowledge of how they tortured the Vietnamese revolutionaries. You actually built a model of the device they used when they electrocuted the genitals of these men. They banged their heads with telephone books. They put a revolver up against their temple and played Russian roulette. They tortured these people. It wasn't just abuse.
Right, and mock executions. I mean, they all have names in the torture lexicon, and one additional one was known as Dry Submarino, which Submarino was putting someone's head underwater and simulating drowning. Well, dry Submarino is putting a bag or a typewriter cover over someone's head and suffocating them and then punching them in the ribs to knock the air out of them to make them think they're suffocating. And that was another tactic that Burge and his men used repeatedly. But, yes, they brought the torture box. I don't know if they brought the box itself, but they brought the concept back from Vietnam. Burge was on a POW camp as a sergeant, and he walked men to and from, and not just men, but men and women, Vietnamese men and women, civilians and military revolutionaries, to interrogation rooms on that POW camp. And it's beyond imagination to think that he would not have known what was going on in those rooms. And, of course, what was going on in those rooms, we've learned from Winter Soldier hearings and other sources over the years, was electric shock and other kinds of torture. So that's where he learned it. He came back. He always wanted to be a Chicago police officer. He became one. He was made a detective within a couple of years. And lo and behold, we start to hear stories of men being electric shocked and having bags put over their heads and having guns put in their mouth and all of the torture techniques that you would expect to hear under apartheid in South Africa and in Central America, places like that where it's been documented. But here it was in the good old U.S. of A., Chicago.
I just want to close, Flint Taylor, with one of the letters that was written to the judge with respect to Burge's sentencing. This was penned by a prisoner who had been in prison for 17 years because he was tortured into confessing to a murder that he didn't commit. He wrote, quote, "I had the body of a man, but I was a child inside." He said everybody lost faith in him except his grandmother, and she grew gray while he was in prison, and she died before he got out. That's, to me, kind of captured the human element of this awful tragedy.
Yes, and then the judges have a tremendous amount of respect for her, and she has a tremendous amount of humanity. And, of course, she went through a life-changing experience when a litigant was mad that she dismissed his pro se case, even though she gave him more of a hearing than any of the other judges he had brought it to, and went to her house and murdered her husband and her mother. And so she's no stranger to violence, but she was very strong and very fair in this case from beginning to end. And I think that everyone should have a tremendous amount of respect for how she addressed this case, because it was not an easy case to try.
Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office, you've devoted over two decades, and you're still devoted to bringing justice to these people in Chicago. And we recognize that, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, I always enjoy coming on, and give my best to Heidi and the other Michael. We'll keep on keeping on this end.
Great. Thanks, Flint.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. We're joined today by attorney Bill Goodman, the former legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill has been an extraordinary public interest lawyer for more than 40 years. He served as counsel on issues including post-Katrina, social justice, public housing, voting rights and the death penalty, living wage and human rights work in Haiti. Bill delivered a speech recently titled "The State of Democratic Rights" to the students at Wayne State University Law School. The speech defines democracy as we now understand it. Welcome, Bill Goodman, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been reflecting on and speaking about the current state of democratic rights in the United States, and that's why we wanted you on the program. You're a longtime practitioner in the area and have thought about it, and I know are quite alarmed at where this country is going. Give us kind of a retrospective since like 9/11 on what you think has been happening.
I think that the way I have talked about this and would talk about it now, will talk about it now, is that if you want to sort of define, to crystallize what American democracy looks like, it's not hard. In maybe seven concepts, you can break it down pretty well. people can't be held, detained, arrested without good cause and without being charged with a crime in front of an independent magistrate. They can't be injured unnecessarily or cruelly, which means they can't be tortured or punished in ways that are extreme. They're allowed to protest publicly, which is what we talk about as First Amendment rights. They can't be discriminated against based upon religion, certainly race, certainly I would say sexual orientation or gender. Those are four pretty primary principles. Then in addition to that, you add on to the importance of separation of powers so that no single branch of government becomes overly important or overreaches. And I should have added the right to privacy, which means that the government can't break into our houses and look, you know, and do unreasonable searches and seizures. And then the right to free and fair elections and have our votes counted fairly and everybody have an equal voice in the way in which the country is ruled. Since 9/11, especially under the Bush administration, but sadly it's continued into the present period, every one of those rights has been under attack except the right to free, fair elections where people's voices have equal say. And
it's a great way to look at democracy today. It's one of the more brilliant analyses, even in the little bit you've talked about. And so I guess your next point is to try and take us through this six or seven, what you consider foundation stones of democracy and what's happened to them.
Indefinite detention. We've seen what's happened in Guantanamo. We've seen this happening in so-called black sites around the world, certainly since 9/11, that people are detained without really being charged with anything. This has been, in one fashion or another, upheld. The United States Supreme Court has held it at arm's length, I would say, thankfully, and has not necessarily condoned it. But it has condoned the concept of the president being able to label people as enemy combatants, and if they are labeled as enemy combatants, to be held indefinitely. That's what was suggested at any rate in the Padilla case and even in Hamdi, I think. I don't think that the status of indefinite detention is very good or very hopeful as far as being treated cruelly and punished unnecessarily. We've seen a rise, and not only a rise, but an attempt to legitimize the use of torture as an instrument of state policy and interrogation. And this has been condoned by the court, sadly, and by the D.C. Circuit in the Rasool case and in cases that have followed Rasool after that, sadly saying that the courts aren't going to intervene. If you talk about searches and seizures, intrusions, the USA Patriot Act, I think, establishes a huge ability for government to engage in searches and seizures without necessarily going in front of a court or having an opportunity to contest these issues, and we've also seen it over and over again in a whole variety of cases. It's on the rise. We've seen the recent grand jury in Chicago, for example, that's going after not the nutcases who really do threaten our society, but the radical left, and it's, I think, a very sad indication of that diminution of our constitutional rights.
On the torture and infliction of pain issue, we've seen, you know, reaction to the photos of Abu Ghraib, but then it seems as though this country has almost become accustomed to our illegal use of torture. You don't see people protesting anymore.
There was some protest in terms of torture, and I guess that's right, Heidi. After Abu Ghraib, there were people who were putting themselves out there with hoods over their heads and that kind of thing. But from a lawyer's perspective, what I see is an unwillingness of the courts to step into the torture situation and really do anything about it. As you all know, and especially Michael Ratner knows, that the Center for Constitutional Rights has a case called Meher Arar versus various individuals and officials of the United States government. And Arar was programmed into a torture situation, horrible torture, in Syria. And the United States participated hand in glove with a regime which it ordinarily labels as being antagonistic to American interests. But here they cooperate with the Syrian regime to torture someone, and the courts refuse to get into the situation, saying this is a situation that will affect foreign policy, and there are national security issues, which is the sole purview of the executive branch of government, and the courts will not intervene to prevent people from being tortured. I mean, in 12, 15, and 13th century, English courts and English magistrates were prepared and willing to step up and take responsibility over such matters. But in the 21st century, American courts refuse. It's depressing and really shameful.
I agree, Bill. That decision you're talking about, Arar, of course, but that's just one of, as when you were even legal director at the center, it's a half a dozen decisions that the center lost challenging torture. And every one of them, the courts figured out some way to throw out. And, you know, rather than look at the foolish legal doctrines they come up with, what you're looking at it is the right way to look at it. Here you've had a society in which torture has flourished and in which the courts have essentially said it's okay to keep doing it.
Yeah, that's right. It is shameful that these judges will not step up to the plate and be willing to say that this cannot happen. It should not happen and will not happen. And this third branch of government is going to prevent it from happening, and that's the way that, again, that American democracy should function. We've seen it not only in Mayor Arar. I mentioned the Rasul case with the D.C. Court of Appeals, horrible opinion, in which they say, no, we're not going to look at the fact that people were tortured at Guantanamo, even though the American Constitution, American law, does run to Guantanamo. And in another CCR case that I'm still working on, is the Al-Zarani case. And that's the case where people were not only tortured at Guantanamo, but there's solid information based upon people who've now left the military who were stationed at Guantanamo at the time that they were murdered at Guantanamo. Nonetheless, the court has said so far, based upon precedent, that we will not step in and just have permit anybody to raise this issue. The courts are stepping out of it, even if the U.S. military not only tortures people, but literally murders them. That's a pretty sad statement about the state of public policy. So moving right along.
Free speech.
I was just about to get there.
Well, then, well, you're free enough to speak right now, Bill.
Freedom of protest, free speech. We saw another CCR case. I hate to keep going back.
Well, you were the legal director twice, a great legal director, some of our most innovative cases, but we'll talk about all that in our introduction. But go ahead, free speech, Bill.
The Humanitarian Law Project case is an example of the dangers which are posed now to the First Amendment of the Constitution by the so-called war on terror. There's a case where the Supreme Court has ruled that basically even if you provide funds or support to an organization in the form of protests, in the form of verbal support, if you support charitable projects, humanitarian projects on the part of organizations that the Treasury Department has labeled as terrorist organizations, or even if you give them legal advice or say, we support the struggle of the Kurds for independence from Turkey or independence from Iran, if you get out there publicly and make those kinds of statements, you now can be prosecuted for criminal activity. There's now an attempt to extend the concept, a very serious attempt to extend the concept of terrorism to the activities of protesters here in the United States, people who work on behalf of the environment, people who work on behalf of animal rights, and therefore if you stand outside of a huge meatpacking plant and decry the fact that animals are slaughtered in inhumane ways, you are now in danger of being prosecuted as a terrorist. And I think it represents a tremendous slippage in the power of the First Amendment. I mean, my God, the United States Supreme Court is happy to say that huge corporations can spend as much money as they possibly want in order to shift and tilt the electoral playing field here in the United States. And that's protected by the First Amendment, and therefore government cannot regulate the ways in which corporations pour money into political campaigns and corrupt the political process, but try to protest the fact that animals are being kept in inhumane ways or slaughtered in inhumane ways, and you're a terrorist.
On the separation of powers issues, Bill, we have the term unitary executive that was bandied about a bit.
This was the neocon term that Bush kind of seized upon in order to drive the country to ruin, I guess. But, yeah, the unitary executive makes decisions and no one can challenge them, and the courts are supposedly out of the fray and can no longer have a role. And that was the legal strategy of the Bush administration for 8 years, say that basically it's a matter of executive prerogative if there's any issue of national security whatsoever, because it's a time of war, and we are at war. We're engaged in a war against terrorism. And therefore, this is a war that has no limits, and chronological limits, has no geographical limits. It applies within the borders of the United States and will apply for generations if these people are to have their way and their say. So therefore, the courts can say nothing about the fact that this wholesale slippage of the Bill of Rights has taken place, and the courts have no role whatsoever in it. Yeah, separation of powers is a big loss. And again, this is something that has been of huge importance ever since at least the 13th century, the Magna Carta, 1215. The king has to respond, has to answer when the magistrate says produce the body. You know, that's the writ of habeas corpus. That is the essence of separation of powers.
Bill, yeah, I know you've thought a lot about this. We all have. How do we get out of where we're at? Where do we begin?
Well, now you're asking me for answers. I mean, I used to say let's file a lawsuit, but now I've just tremendously weakened that approach, haven't I? I think that we've always been strongest in support of the Bill of Rights and in furthering our rights in court when we've had an active, aggressive, assertive movement in the streets. That's certainly true during the civil rights period. I mean, it's no accident that the Warren Court, which supported the advances that were made by the civil rights movement in this country in the early 60s, became also a strong supporter of so many other aspects of the Bill of Rights as well. That's what I think we need now. In order to be able to strengthen the Constitution, we need active, aggressive organizing of a movement. That means a revitalization of the labor movement. You can see some signs of that happening. It's very heartening, for example, here in Detroit, we can talk about the new UAW with uncritical of any large organization, leadership of any large organization. But Bob King, the new president of the UAW, holds out, I think, some hope that there's going to be organizing and that there's going to be assertion of the rights of working people and the rights of families in this country. That's what we can hope for. I mean, as King talks about it, as politicians even talk about it, middle-class America today is under huge attack, and we can see it happening everywhere. I don't think public education, if we're continuing the same trajectory that we're going, can last for very long in this country, for a generation. I don't, you know, within a generation, I think we can see the end of public education in the United States. Now, if that doesn't generate a movement, it ought to generate a strong, aggressive, vocal movement, just that alone.
Bill, I'd just like you to summarize very quickly the seven foundation pieces of democracy. Again, the one-liner you opened the show with, the seven that you think are a good way or good lens to look through whether we still have democracy in the United States.
A, indefinite detention. B, torture and cruel punishment. C, no unlawful, unreasonable searches and seizures. That is a right of privacy. D, protection against discrimination based upon race, gender, ethnic origin, and so on. E, freedom of speech and freedom of protest. F would be electoral freedom and a transparent election process.
And G would be separation.
Oh, separation of powers.
G for government.
That made seven.
Seven. We really appreciate your doing that.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Talk to y'all later.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
But we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. hurt us at home. They beat us at school. And they hate us when we're clever. Despise us when we're fools. Yeah, they got us so fucking crazy. We cannot follow their rules.
Today, we're joined by Sarah Hogarth, who has recently returned from Honduras. We talk with her about her observations on the post-coup human rights crisis in that country. As listeners know, on June 28th of 2009, the Honduran military ousted the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. Former parliamentary speaker Roberto Micheletti was sworn in as Zelaya's replacement. Repressive tactics were used immediately after the coup. Those who oppose this regime have been beaten and illegally detained by the state. The hand of the United States behind the whole operation is quite evident. Sarah Hogarth, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. James Cockcroft, welcome also to Law and Disorder. We're glad to have you here as our guest interviewer, a longtime Latin American scholar and radical activist. Sarah, I understand you were in Honduras last month. Can you tell us what the reason was that you went down there, and then we can talk about what your findings were?
Sure. I went with an organization called Friendship Office of the Americas, and the purpose was to meet with the social movement leaders and the human rights organizations there and talk about the human rights situation in Honduras since the general elections a year ago, November 2009.
How would you characterize those elections of a year ago?
One thing I think is important for Americans particularly to understand is that the elections were broadly considered to be illegitimate, enough so that the United Nations and other international organizations did not attend to observe, and the major opposition candidates actually withdrew and did not participate. And the social movement there, the organized resistance to the coup that had happened the previous June, publicly boycotted them.
Is it fair to say that the coup is still going on?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the best way to characterize it.
Talk to us about the role of the United States prior to the coup and now.
Well, the international community, after the coup in June, everybody publicly agreed that that was a military coup and that the human rights situation deteriorated dramatically immediately afterwards, with protesters being killed, radio stations being shut down. But then there were previously scheduled elections for November 2009. While the opposition didn't participate fully, the position of the United States government is that those were legitimate elections and that they have recognized the current regime of Lobo regime, and they've renewed cooperation with the Honduran government.
Jim Cockcroft, let me draw you into this conversation. What's your take on why the United States stood behind this coup? What is their interest?
Well, first of all, the president who was overthrown had brought Honduras into ALBA, which is the Fair Trade Organization of Latin America, led by Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, and Nicaragua and several other countries in the Caribbean, above all. So Honduras, as with all Central America, is bordering on the Caribbean. And this man who was overthrown by a military coup was sticking in the throat of Washington. So Washington's ambassador and the military base outside of Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, a U.S. military base, conspired basically to support this coup when it happened, and even flew the outgoing president out from the U.S. base. And the whole world knew this, but the United States said it wasn't a coup. Now WikiLeaks, of course, has shown that the ambassador was already telling Washington it's a coup. So there was this propaganda campaign to cleanse a vicious military coup that's a throwback to the dirty wars of the 1960s in Latin America and early 70s and 80s, Pinochet style, as in Chile and so on. Wouldn't you agree, by the way?
I would, certainly. Yeah. Although I think it's interesting to point that Zelaya, who was the president that was removed by the coup, was not the most radical of political leaders by any stretch. No. He also joined CAFTA. He brought Honduras into that as well. He didn't consider
that.
Which is
a South American free trade organization sponsored by the United States. No, he was part of the oligarchy.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But the National Resistance Movement has really sort of put all those folks in the past. They are the action in Honduras today, and that's why they're being so repressed. At least that's what I've been told.
I think that's right. The resistance movement there truly is an inspiration. I was very inspired to meet the diversity and the level of information and the solidarity that is going on amongst the Frente is really impressive.
Talk to us more about that, Sarah. What sorts of people are involved? What are they doing? How do they communicate with each other? How do they organize? I imagine that it's quite difficult under those circumstances to resist. Nonetheless, they are. And you went down there and observed what they were doing.
Yeah. Well, they came together immediately within hours of the coup. And it was a truly broad swath of civil society that was represented. There's the labor movement. There's women's organizations. There's lesbian, gay, transgender groups, indigenous organizations, and campesino organizations as well. And they communicated and coordinated support for those opposing the coup publicly instantly after the coup happened. And then in the months since, after they made a decision not to participate in the illegitimate elections because they decided that a government that was assassinating and disappearing and torturing the people could not run a fair, open election, since that time, things have gotten substantially worse for them in many ways because the new regime has instituted anti-terrorism, so-called anti-terrorism legislation that they feel is setting them up to be targeted as an armed organization. People of Nicaraguan background are being especially targeted with respect to this also, and the border regions are particularly nervous. One thing your listeners might be interested in is the community radio movement in Honduras is really impressive. It's the primary means that the Frente constituents communicate with each other and try to disseminate real news about what's happening.
Yeah, I just want to add about the community radio because Americans really should know this. There was a time right after the coup when all the community radio was not only shut down by the military, but its equipment destroyed. And within 48 hours, community radio stations from the rest of Latin America rushed to the borders of Honduras to keep communications going into Honduras among the resistors. So this is a movement that goes way beyond Honduras.
That's true. But in Honduras, the journalists have been tremendously targeted.
Exactly.
Journalists and queer activists, actually, are the two groups that have experienced the most murders and disappearances.
We're speaking to Sarah Hogarth, who's just returned from a trip to Honduras last month, and Dr. James Cockcroft, the Latin American scholar and radical activist. Sarah, what kind of things can people here in the United States do to support the struggle in Honduras?
One thing I think that people should understand is that the call for international visibility and solidarity is very clear and strong from the Frente. It really does make a difference there. I think that's hard for us to understand as Americans, where the impact of foreign opinion maybe isn't as significant. But people want to be not invisible. They want the international community to understand what is happening there. And importantly, they want the money flow to stop. I was in a farming community and an older campesino stood up and he said, look, the International Development Bank and the Americans are giving money to this regime and they use it to hire thugs to kill campesinos. It needs to stop.
Is there a website that people can go to plug into this?
Yes, there is. The Friendship Office has a website, and the Frente does also. The Friendship Office is friendshipamericas.org. The FNRP, which is the official resistance movement, is resistenciahonduras.net.
Jim, let me ask you if you would put the coup in Honduras in perspective in light of the role that the United States has played historically in Latin America, because the coup, I don't think, surprised any of us, except maybe totally religious believers in Obama.
Well, exactly. The Obama administration came in promising a new face on American policy vis-a-vis Latin America, but it's carried out the old policy that dates from the Monroe Doctrine right through all the interventions, hundreds of military interventions by U.S. Marines. 6,000 Marines were just recently sent to Costa Rica. What's that about? Costa Rica is the only country in Latin America that didn't have an army because of a revolution that they had down there.
and there's new American military bases in Honduras now.
And of course, they added two. First, right away, they built a new military base in Honduras. Now they're adding a second one. They're adding four or five in Panama. They just established six more U.S. military bases in Colombia. They're militarizing Mexico. This whole foreign policy of the United States has fundamentally been an extension and deepening of the Bush policy of militarization of the world. You watch a Super Bowl game or whatever, football, and they advertise, this goes out to all our loyal troops in 175 countries of the world. So this is very serious indeed for the world and for humanity.
Sarah, what are your thoughts on that?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the increased militarization and the role of the United States is clearly understood to be the player, the key player behind that. And one thing, too, that's interesting is this is happening largely in the context it's being pitched as being part of the war on drugs. There's an important connection there, I think, for people to make.
Yeah, I would quite agree. In fact, I just finished reading Jim Cockcroft's new book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, and there's a whole section on just what you said, that they disguise the imperial intervention with, quote, the war on drugs, but it has nothing to do with the war on drugs.
When human rights defenders are disappeared, they are often billed in the media locally as having been narco-traffickers or gang members, and that is what allows the government to just say that investigating is not important.
Yeah. And the media is totally controlled in Mexico by only two stations, in Honduras by I don't know how many, but I'm sure it's
and very tied to
the community
oligarchy.
Radio, and they can get away with those kinds of lies. What can you tell us about the roles of the different forces in society, the women's movement, the queer movement, the peasants in Honduras? What role are they playing?
One of the things that really struck me is how the level of solidarity between all these vast, diverse parts of Honduran society. The labor movement has traditionally been quite strong in Honduras and has been tremendously active. The land struggles are a huge, huge issue that has been complicated and hurt by the coup situation. There is an extremely small amount of arable land in Honduras and many, many generations of people that get inherited and purchased and bought and sold along with the land that they've been working on. And there were beginnings of land reform going on before the coup, and since then the military has moved in and has been disappearing and massive disinformation campaigns against campesino organizers.
Jim, same question to you.
Absolutely true, but the level of unity that Sarah's been talking about among all these different groups of civil society is truly impressive. I would compare what's going on with the popular resistance in Honduras to what we saw happen in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and other parts of Latin America throughout the past 10 years of this new century. And in many ways, it's a new example of how people can unite and fight against overwhelming odds, where you have a powerful U.S. imperialist presence. I think that's why Sarah and so many others who work with the resistance or interview the resistance, as I do from Montreal, Canada, come away crying for the public to know about this so that the U.S. will stop supporting these bloody dictators.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's truly, it was an inspiration to meet all those people. Another element that I think is also familiar and discouraging is the extreme privatization that has happened during this past year under this new regime. They have given away the farm to the concessions to these private large corporations for development without any level of consultation with the communities. There's a tremendous resistance to that going on in many, many different regions of the country, including a very active indigenous movement.
Which is true of all Central America and Mexico and many other countries in the region.
What strikes me is the prevalence of the gay community in Honduras in this. And that's not something you could have said for radical movements in Latin America years ago. This is something really new on the horizon. Talk to us about what you saw down there.
Of course, what's new, of course, is the level of visibility. I mean, people have always been there. as is true of women, most vulnerable elements of society get hurt disproportionately when there's an increase in impunity and an increase of state violence. And this has impacted women, and it's impacted the queer community tremendously. So that when the queer activists are visible and have been active in the Frente, they've been experiencing assassinations and disappearances at a terrifying rate.
And the public should know that rape, which your listeners know is a military weapon commonly used throughout the world by imperialist powers, is absolutely rampant in Honduras, especially against women.
That's right.
Not to mention other victims.
And murder of women. Femicide is increased.
Feminicide. Feminicide and juvenicidio in Spanish, or youthicide. To be female or young in Honduras or Mexico today is almost really to be criminal. You are subject to brutal attacks, and whether you're queer or not, by the way, you know, and murder. These two terms, feminicide and youthicide, are now common parlance throughout Central America and Mexico.
That's true. But even in the face of that, the youth movement, too, is tremendous. I mean, the groups of young people that have been tremendously visible and vocal and have taken real leadership positions in the organized resistance.
It's a young movement, to play on words, not only in its duration so far, but in its composition. The vast majority of Hondurans are young, and the vast majority back the popular resistance.
Sarah, I want you to, again, give our listeners those two websites.
Sure. The Friendship Office, if people are interested in getting involved from the United States, is friendshipamericas.org. And the FNRP, the National Popular Resistance Front of Honduras, has a website as well that is mostly in Spanish, but it has some English pages. And it's resistenciahonduras, all one word, .net.
Sarah, we're going to wrap it up presently, but I wanted to ask you for any final thoughts that you might have on the ongoing coup supported by the U.S. in Honduras.
Well, I think we should all keep the Honduras movement in our hearts and our minds, and make sure that what is happening there is not allowed to remain invisible. And at the same time, I think we should remember the solidarity that we can demonstrate to our fellow movements.
I would certainly emphasize that international solidarity. There are links now throughout Canada, the United States, and the Americas in general, linking up young people's movements, First Nation people's movements, original people's movements, Indians, so-called, queer movements, student movements, fair trade movements against all these disastrous neoliberal free trade policies that end up laying millions of people off with no future, especially the young. Without that linkage that many of your listeners can be part of by going to those websites and speaking more with Sarah and other solidarity groups, we will not succeed either there, south of the border, or here in the United States, not to mention Canada.
Sarah Hogarth, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jim, thanks for participating in this important interview. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questa fossa dove stai? Larga pochettita.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.
Non è una fossa grande, è giusta precisa, è la terra che volevi veder divisa. È una fossa grande per un piccolo morto, mai più spazio attorno di quando eri al mondo.
Mai più spazio attorno di quando eri al mondo.
È una fossa grande per un morto da niente, ma qui più che nel mondo stai comodamente. È una fossa grande, la tua carne è poca, ma la terra donata non si guarda in bocca.
Ma la terra donata non si guarda in bocca.
you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.